Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Des Moines Register for Wednesday, July 29th, 2020. I'm your reader, Dennis May. Things are changing very quickly, and IRIS wants to make sure we provide our listeners with as much information as we can. In order to do that, we have changed our program schedule completely. This schedule will air statewide on all platforms until further notice. We will also include information about resources in your community during each paper. You'll still hear your Des Moines Register each day at 9 a.m., 6 p.m., and 1 a.m. Please listen closely to the following changes for all other newspapers. The Fort Dodge Messenger will be read at 7 a.m., Monday through Friday. The Mason City Globe-Gazette will be read at 8 a.m., Monday through Friday. Your Des Moines Register will continue to be read from 9 a.m. until noon. The Cedar Rapids Gazette will be read at noon, 7 days a week. The Waterloo-Cedar Falls Courier will be read at 1 p.m., 7 days a week. The Dubuque Telegraph Herald will be read at 2 p.m., Monday through Friday. The Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil will be read at 3 p.m., Monday through Friday. The Sioux City Journal will be read at 4 p.m., 7 days a week. The Ames Tribune will be read at 5 p.m., Monday through Friday. And the Midweek Shopping Cart will be read each Wednesday at 9 p.m. Recordings of all newspapers will be available on our podcast page. Just go to iowaradioreading.org, click Listen Now, then click Listen to IRIS Podcasts. The papers are organized by region. Each paper will be available for 7 days. As things continue to change, we will announce schedule changes each hour at 56 minutes past the hour going forward. Keep yourself safe, and thank you for listening. And now, let's take a look at today's weather. The AccuWeather forecast calls for variable cloudiness today, a thunderstorm in the west in the afternoon, partly sunny near Des Moines, humid to the east, winds north-northwest 3 to 6 miles per hour. The forecast for Des Moines calls for a high of 89 and a low of 70, variable cloudiness, winds from the east 4 to 8 miles per hour, a couple of strong thunderstorms around tonight. On Thursday, a high of 81 with a low of 64, clouds and sunshine, and then Friday, a high of 82 with a low of 63, partly sunny, and a thunderstorm. Across the area today, variable cloudiness, a couple of strong thunderstorms at night, winds from the east at 4 to 8 miles per hour, and on Thursday, clouds and sunshine, winds from the northeast, 7 to 14 miles per hour. Our sunrise today was at 6:07 a.m. and will set at 8:35 p.m. Moonrise today at 4:24 p.m. and set at 1:30 a.m. Turning to the headlines in today's Des Moines Register, Renaissance Festival's Joust for Event Mastery, Fairway says no to cans and bottles, and officials say don't open unsolicited seed bags. We'll start with Susan A. Porter's article, Renaissance Festival's Joust for Event Mastery. Former organizers now battle as competitors. A feud between organizers of a long-running Renaissance Festival in Des Moines has resulted in two competing events now jousting for crowds, period reenactors, and costume merchants who hawk ale, turkey legs, and such items as replica swords and battle axes. The Des Moines Renaissance Fair starts August 7th near Sailorville, while the Renaissance Fair at Sleepy Hollow Sports Park begins September 5th. Organizers of the event split in 2016 after a decade-long partnership at the Sleepy Hollow location. They first competed for crowds last year when both held events during the same weekend, but that duel ended when the Sailorville event folded its tents early because of low attendance, said Gregory Schmidt, who started the event. The Sleepy Hollow event went on to attract a record of nearly 14,000 attendees, said its owner, Rick Flatt. Although this year's events take place almost a month apart, the competition remains heated, even for the claim as to which is the authentic festival. On his website, Flatt prominently details the festival's history at Sleepy Hollow, saying the event is celebrating 15 years. Schmidt markets the Sailorville event as your original and family-friendly festival in a new location. If you attended any of the Renaissance festivals at Sleepy Hollow from 2006 to 2015, you were at our event, his website says. Schmidt and other organizers of the event near Sailorville say they first became involved in the Iowa Renaissance Festival, held in Mason City and Des Moines, before moving to the Amana colonies in the early 1990s. They announced the launch of the Des Moines Renaissance Fair in 2003. The first few years of Des Moines' event were challenging, including flooding in 2004 that forced the event to relocate from Waterworks Park to the Iowa State Fairgrounds. Flat, the longtime owner of the Sleepy Hollow Event Center, contacted Schmidt soon after the 2004 flood to ask if the Des Moines Renaissance organizers would be interested in using his property. Schmidt said he was eager to partner with Flat because he wanted a permanent site with buildings similar to those used for Renaissance festivals in Kansas City, Missouri, and Minneapolis. Flat and Schmidt ultimately negotiated a 10-year contract that, beginning in 2006, gave the Des Moines event a long-time home. They split the profits. But the business relationship wasn't always harmonious. There were disagreements about how the festival should operate, Flat said. He alleges Schmidt wanted to retire from the Renaissance business around 2016 when the contract was to expire. Schmidt acknowledged they did entertain the idea of retirement, but said Flat and his business partner were unwilling to pay an amount he believed was fair to purchase the festival. Flat told the Register that he turned down at least one offer for $20,000 to purchase the name, but said he also was warned there would be consequences if he did not buy it, an accusation Schmidt denies. With the two unable to come to an agreement, Schmidt lost the use of the Sleepy Hollow location in 2016. Flat that year changed the name of the event at his venue to the Renaissance Fair at Sleepy Hollow. Meanwhile, Schmidt, because of a non-compete clause with Flat, was unable to continue with the Des Moines Renaissance Festival in 2017 and 2018. Schmidt announced on the last day of that non-compete agreement in 2018 that the first Des Moines Renaissance Fair near Sailorville would be taking place in 2019 on the same dates as the Sleepy Hollow event. Strife between Schmidt and Flat heightened because, according to Flat, Schmidt had an issue with the non-compete agreements that Flat required performers and vendors to sign. That agreement prohibited performers from appearing at another Renaissance or medieval event within a 90-mile radius during the same calendar year. Lynn Melson is a former entertainment director who worked for both Schmidt and Flat during their Renaissance partnership. She said the relationship unraveled because Schmidt, whom she claims was not very computer literate or well organized, made promises he didn't keep. Melson is now a scriptwriter for Flat at the Sleepy Hollow event. Schmidt was going to actively audition acts. He was going to train up new acts, and that never happened, Melson said. He never did what he said he was going to do. Schmidt denies Melson's characterization, writing in an email that although he conducted a limited number of auditions locally, he and his wife consistently traveled all around the Midwest and still do, going to other festivals to find professional acts. Not everyone who has business ties with Schmidt agrees with Melson's view of the Clear Lake Native. Jonathan Gill, alongside his wife, played a king character at the Des Moines Renaissance Festival at Sailorville last year. Gill, who lives in Marshalltown, believes that hosting a festival at the same time as the Sleepy Hollow event was a bad business decision. But he contends that Schmidt is a dedicated and passionate Renaissance professional, all the same. He said he believes some of the challenges at Schmidt's event last year can be attributed to Flat requiring reenactment professionals, himself included, to sign a non-compete agreement. In essence, he was forced to choose sides. Gill signed the contract in 2016, when there were no dueling festivals, but has since returned his allegiance to Schmidt at the Sailorville event. I was told in no short order that I was either to sign it as is, or they had enough other people that would want to get hired, Gill said. Schmidt does not ask performers to sign non-compete contracts. They can work anytime, anywhere they want, he said. Flat, however, said he believes such contracts are necessary. Nobody wants to go out and spend money on an entertainer, sign a contract that they're going to do an event for you, and then find out that 2 days before your event's going to happen, they took another gig at a bar across town, Flat said. Schmidt is involved in a similar Renaissance Fair dispute in Nebraska, where about 15 years ago he began working with Omaha native Howard Coffin on the Nebraska Renaissance Fair. The two ended their Renaissance partnership around 2014. Schmidt remains involved with the Nebraska event and another known as the Midlands Pirate Festival. Coffin has launched his own event, the Renaissance Festival of Nebraska at the Bellevue Berry Farm. Schmidt said Coffin failed to pay a lease fee to take over their longtime event and, instead, got together with the location property owners and simply had us kicked out. Coffin said the allegation is untrue. He and some of his business partners launched their own festival because they wanted to do more with the event than Schmidt did, he said. We decided the best thing would be to go out and do the festival on our own, Coffin said. Because of the coronavirus pandemic, the Nebraska events have been canceled this year, but in Iowa both festivals will continue as planned. Melson said she believes that there's no issue with two such events operating in the state. Both of these events are for-profit events. I mean, if I wanted to, you wanted to, you could start your own Renaissance Fair. I mean, it's whatever you want to do, Melson said. And our next article, written by Lee Brood, Fairway says no to cans and bottles, site safety in not reopening redemptions. Fairway's announcement this week that its stores will not accept cans and bottles for redemption triggered debate among hundreds of Iowans on social media, as other major chains like Hy-Vee and Come & Go decided to resume collections despite health concerns. The Boone-based grocery chain's announcement came after Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds last week lifted part of an emergency declaration that, since March, had allowed stores to suspend redemption of cans and bottles for the 5-cent deposit required under state law. In a statement posted on Facebook, Fairway said it had decided not to resume redemption to minimize potential harm to the communities we serve. Health authorities continue to advise that COVID-19 and other viruses are transmitted through respiratory droplets, Fairway representatives said in the statement. Accepting potentially contaminated containers inside our store presents a great risk of harm to the health and safety of our employees and customers. It also said, allowing used containers to be returned to our stores puts our employees and customers at risk and runs counterproductive to the many safety and sanitation initiatives we have implemented in order to keep the people safe. Chain representatives said each store has posted a notice directing customers to nearby redemption centers where they can take their cans and bottles. On Fairway's Facebook page, scores of Iowans debated the chain's intentions, whether Fairway stores should require masks of all employees and customers, as more Iowa retailers are doing, and questioned the legality of refusing to redeem containers. John Wagner of Centerville drew dozens of responses after posting, "It is very encouraging to see that Fairway is concerned about the health and safety of their customers and community. How about going the distance and requiring a mask? Maybe this concern is more about dodging the responsibility of redeeming a product they sell." In response to another comment about masks, a Fairway representative responded, "We've instructed our customers to wear them, if able. Our customers have been responsive in following this directive, but we've heard from individuals who are unable to safely wear a face covering, which is why we've implemented numerous measures for additional cleaning and encourage keeping proper distance." Several Iowans reached out to Watchdog this summer, wondering why grocery chains continue to charge Iowans deposits on containers under the state's bottle bill, even though they weren't offering redemptions. Now that the suspension is lifted, retailers who refuse to redeem cans and bottles that were purchased at their stores can be charged with a simple misdemeanor under state law. But enforcement is up to local authorities, not the state Department of Natural Resources, which oversees the system, said Amy Davidson, a DNR bureau chief. Davidson said the DNR had received 10 complaints about Walmart, Hy-Vee, and Fairway stores not redeeming containers, but she said she did not have a record of locations for each complaint. "We have been informing complainants that they can contact local law enforcement if they desire," she said. Ann Safarer, a spokesperson for the Iowa Grocery Industry Association, said Tuesday that Fairway is not the only retailer to opt against taking cans and bottles for now, but she did not identify other businesses. "Accepting containers for redemption inside stores where there is not adequate space, separation, and machines to handle them presents an increased risk to the health and safety of their employees and customers," she said in a statement. Grocers tried, but ultimately failed, this year to implement changes to Iowa's Beverage Containers Control Law. The statute has been credited with reducing litter and encouraging more recycling, but the Iowa Grocery Industry Association, which has opposed the system, pushed hard to get redemption centers out of grocery stores. It appealed to lawmakers for changes and filing a petition with the DNR to overhaul rules governing how the bottle bill works. The availability of can and bottle redemption centers at grocery stores has been hit and miss across the state since Reynolds issued a public health emergency on March 17th. The sweeping proclamation gave businesses the option of not taking those items during the pandemic. Regional redemption centers were open, but grocery stores made decisions about their own centers on a location-by-location basis. With the lifting of Reynolds' order, West Des Moines-based Hy-Vee, Iowa's largest grocery chain, said it resumed collection of bottles and cans this week at stores with redemption centers. Like Fairway, it requires employees to wear masks and encourages customers to do so, recently announcing it would provide masks to people entering its stores, but it only requires customers to wear them in locales where they have been mandated by state or local government. Come and Go stores also have resumed can and bottle redemption, a company spokesperson said. Employees are required to wear masks when interacting with customers or fellow employees. We follow state and local ordinances when it comes to customers, said spokesperson Ariel Rubin. Under the 1979 bottle bill, distributors charge retailers 5 cents for every can and bottle they stock. Iowans who buy beer, soft drinks, wine, or liquor then pay a 5-cent deposit to the retailer on each container. They get their 5 cents back when they return empties to a regional or retail-based redemption center. When distributors pick up the return containers, they pay the retailers 5 cents, plus a penny handling fee for each one. Emily Toribio, a Fairway spokesperson, said she did not know how long the chain would suspend redemptions, but she noted that other retailers, public buildings with vending machines, dollar stores, hardware stores, big box stores, movie theaters, and sandwich shops, have unabashedly never offered redemption options at any location. The Grocery Industry Association sufferer echoed Fairway's objections. Grocery and convenience stores are being held to the letter of the law, while other retailers are not, she said. The law is not enforced in an equitable manner. When asked if any workers or customers had gotten sick with COVID-19 as a result of redemptions, sufferer said the ban had just lifted, so she could not identify anyone. We do know that the virus is transported through respiratory droplets, and for this reason, many redemption centers also were closed and some remain closed, she said. Bottle and can redemption also takes employees away from other important cleaning and safety measures. The association asked consumers to consider taking their containers to a redemption center or to a location that has a redemption room separate from the store. And the last article on the front page, written by staff and Wire reporters, officials say don't open unsolicited seed bags. Officials in Iowa and several other states are warning residents not to plant unsolicited packages of seeds that appear to have been mailed from China in connection with what the U.S. Department of Agriculture said may be a scam. The state has received about 24 calls, which began over the weekend and continued rolling in on Tuesday, said Robin Prusner, the Iowa Department of Agriculture's entomologist. She said some callers had received the seeds in recent days, but others reported receiving them a month ago. Some of the packages are labeled as jewelry, and many have messages in Chinese on them, according to agricultural officials. The Iowa Department of Agriculture, in a Facebook post, said it was awaiting guidances from the U.S. Department of Agriculture on how to handle the seeds. If you receive a package in the meantime, please do not open the seed packet, plant the seed, or destroy the seed, it advised. Some people responded to the post with photos of packages with return addresses in China that they said they had received. A photo of one that a Cedar Rapids recipient said contained seeds included a manifest listing the contents as, quote, grass stud earrings. Lori Colley of 12, Utah, told Salt Lake City TV news station Fox 13 she was excited to find two small packages in her mailbox that appeared to contain earrings. I opened them up, and they were seeds, Colley said. Obviously, they're not jewelry. Colley told the outlet she posted about the strange incident on Facebook, and at least 40 people reached out to her saying something similar happened to them. Texas Agriculture Commissioner Sid Miller issued a news release urging Texans not to plant the seeds, as they may contain harmful invasive species or otherwise be unsafe. An invasive plant species might not sound threatening, but these small invaders could destroy Texas agriculture, Miller warned. Prusner asked that Iowans not open or handle the seeds, since they appear to be covered with an unknown seed treatment. Since it's unlabeled, we don't know if it's legal or safe, she said. The Agriculture Department asked residents who received the seeds to call 515-281-5321. In addition to aiding the state and federal investigation, the state wants to ensure the seeds are properly handled and destroyed, Prusner said. Similar requests were issued around the country. Right now, we are uncertain what type of seeds are in the package, said Mike Strain, commissioner of the Louisiana Department of Agriculture and Forestry. We need to identify the seeds to ensure that they do not pose a risk to Louisiana's agriculture industry or the environment. Agriculture officials in Washington state urged residents to report such agricultural smuggling to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. A spokesperson for the USDA said the department's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service urges anyone who has received the seeds to contact their state plant regulators and keep the seeds and packaging, including the mailing label, until they receive further instructions. At this time, we don't have any evidence indicating this is something other than a brushing scam where people receive unsolicited items from a seller who then posts false customer reviews to boost sales, the statement said. USDA is currently collecting seed packages from recipients and will test their contents and determine if they contain anything that could be of concern to U.S. agriculture or the environment. Turning the page, millions poured into mail-in voting fight from the Associated Press, spending likely to swell higher as election nears. Deep-pocketed and often anonymous donors are pouring over $100 million into an intensifying dispute about whether it should be easier to vote by mail, a fight that could determine President Donald Trump's fate in the November election. In the battleground of Wisconsin, cash-strapped cities have received $6.3 million from an organization with ties to left-wing philanthropy to help expand vote by mail. Meanwhile, a well-funded conservative group best known for its focus on judicial appointments is spending heavily to fight cases related to mail-in balloting procedures in court. And that's just a small slice of the overall spending, which is likely to swell far higher as the election nears. The massive effort by political parties, super PACs, and other organizations to fight over whether Americans can vote by mail is remarkable considering the practice has long been non-controversial. But the coronavirus is forcing changes to the way states conduct elections and prompting activists across the political spectrum to seek an advantage, recognizing the contest between Trump and Democrat Joe Biden could hinge on whether voters have an alternative to standing in lines at polling places during a public health crisis. Some groups are even raising money to prepare for election-related violence. The pandemic has created a state of emergency, said Lale Ispahani, the U.S. Managing Director for Open Society, a network of nonprofits founded by billionaire progressive donor George Soros. Donors who haven't typically taken on these issues now have an interest. How much will be spent is unclear because many of the organizations are nonprofits that won't disclose those details to the IRS until well after the election. Even then, many sources of money will remain unknown because such groups don't have to disclose their donors, commonly referred to as dark money. Tax filings, business records, and campaign finance disclosures offer some clues. They reveal vast infrastructure that funnels money from wealthy donors through philanthropic organizations and political groups, which eventually trickles down to smaller nonprofits, many of which operate under murky circumstances. On the conservative side, organizations including Judicial Watch, the Honest Elections Project, True the Vote, and the Public Interest Legal Foundation are litigating cases relating to voting procedures across the U.S. A substantial portion of the financing comes from Donors Trust, a nonprofit often referred to as the, quote, dark money ATM of the conservative movement. The organization helps wealthy patrons invest in causes they care about while sheltering their identities from the public. In other instances, funding comes from charitable foundations built by the fortunes of Gilded Age industrialists. Litigation is a primary focus. Democrats and good government organizations are pushing to eliminate hurdles to absentee voting, like requiring a witness's signature or allowing third parties to collect ballots. Conservatives say that amounts to an invitation to commit voter fraud. As these issues wind their way through the courts, they say judges could decide complex policy matters that often were already debated by state legislatures. The wrong way to go about this is to run to court, particularly a week or two before an election, trying to get judges to intervene and second-guess decisions legislatures have made, said Jason Sneed, the executive director of the Honest Elections Project. His organization is a newly formed offshoot of the Judicial Education Project, a group that previously focused on judicial appointments and received more than $25.3 million between 2016 and 2018 from the Donors Trust, records show. They are deeply intertwined with the conservative Catholic legal movement and share an attorney, William Consovi, with the Republican National Committee, which has pledged $20 million for voting litigation. Leonard Leo, a Trump confidant who was instrumental in the confirmations of the president's Supreme Court nominees, plays a leading role. He's now chairman of a public relations firm called CRC Advisors, which is overseeing a new effort to establish a clearinghouse for anonymous donors to fund conservative causes, including the fight over the vote by mail. The firm played a significant role in the 2004 election by publicizing unfounded claims made by a group called Swift Vote Veterans for Truth, which questioned Democratic nominee John Kerry's record as a Vietnam War hero, records show. The group's involvement in vote by mail marks a sea change for Republicans. Claims of widespread voter fraud have long energized segments of the party's base. But it did not elicit much interest from donors, and the handful of groups devoted to the issue operated on minuscule budgets. But in recent years, Democrats have mounted legal challenges that threatened voting laws championed by conservatives. And Trump's repeated focus on rigged elections has made the issue part of a broader cultural war. Still, some activists question the GOP establishment's commitment to the cause. "They aren't going to take on Republicans like we have," said Katherine Engelbrecht, the founder of the True the Vote. While Republicans are focused on the courts and raising doubts about vote by mail, the challenge faced by Democrats is far more daunting. In addition to litigation, they must mobilize their base during a pandemic. That includes educating the public about vote by mail, a difficult task when door-to-door canvassing isn't an option. Some groups are donating directly to local governments. In Wisconsin, the Center for Tech and Civic Life, a nonprofit with ties to left-leaning philanthropy, has donated $6.3 million to the state's five largest cities to set up ballot drop boxes, help voters file absentee ballot requests, and expand in-person early voting. Even before the pandemic, government funding for elections was limited. Since then, the outbreak has escalated costs while cratering tax revenue. "Due to COVID, there definitely has been a higher cost," said Mayor John Antarmian of Kenosha, which received $863,000 through the grant, roughly four times what the city budgeted for the election. "Is there a financial shortfall on that basis? Of course. Much of the money on the left is likely to come from a series of nonprofit funds controlled by the consulting firm Arabella Advisors, which typically routes upwards of $500 million a year to causes supported by liberal donors. The firm was founded by Eric Kessler, who served in Bill Clinton's White House. The firm has been instrumental in financing so-called resistance groups following Trump's election, and some nonprofits they've provided seed money were responsible for millions of dollars in TV advertising that blistered Republicans during the 2018 midterms. They've also pioneered the practice of creating pop-up organizations, groups that appear to be grassroots-driven efforts to influence public policy, which use trade names that obscure a deep pool of resources from those with ideological or financial motivations. The firm recently registered a handful of trade names for groups that appear to be focused on voting rights, records show. Another effort Arabella Advisors are involved in, the Trusted Elections Fund, aims to raise between $8 million and $10 million in case the pandemic leads to chaos in November. The group is preparing for potential foreign hacking of states' voting systems, election day or post-election day violence, as well as contested results. A Trusted Elections Fund representative declined to comment, but a two-page summary available online elaborated on their aims. "Philanthropy has a responsibility to make sure that we are prepared for emergencies that could threaten our democracy," it read. From Iowa City, deal will save Iowa City House, tout writing space. Iowa City and the University of Iowa have worked out a deal that will preserve a 177-year-old house while providing space for the university's nonfiction writing program. The new location would be part of a writing neighborhood near two other historic buildings along Clinton Street that house the Iowa Writers' Workshop and Iowa's International Writing Program, the Cedar Rapids Gazette reported. The city is offering the $1 million piece of property, which is currently a parking lot, at no cost to the university, but there will be a hefty price tag for moving the historic Zangzi Gilmer House to the property. A city assessment put the cost of moving and renovating the structure at over $1.23 million. A university official said the school plans to cover expenses with a substantial gift. Officials declined to give details on the donation. The Iowa City Historic Preservation Commission and the City Council both approved the property transfer. The university had planned to demolish the historic home, but city and preservation officials say the house is an important piece of Iowa City history. built in 1843. It's one of the oldest structures in Iowa City and is associated with the Sangsees, considered a founding family in Iowa City. In 2015, the Preservation Commission identified the Sangsee-Gilmer House as its top priority for historic landmark designation. And from Guatemala, Guatemala teacher peddles classroom to students. When the novel coronavirus closed Guatemala schools in mid-March, teacher Geraldo Excoy invested his savings in a second-hand adult tricycle. But this is not just transportation. It is also a mobile classroom with plastic sheets to protect against virus transmission, a whiteboard, and a small solar panel that powers an audio player he uses for lessons. Each day, the 27-year-old pedals among the cornfields of Santa Cruz del Quiche to give individual instruction to his 6th-grade students. On a recent day, 12-year-old Paola Xmena Conez wiped her glasses as she waited for Ixcoy to set up just outside the door to her home. They greeted each other warmly, though without contact. Ixcoy deployed the mop that measures the distance between him and his students. Standing behind the plexiglass window on his tricycle, he produced a pizza box. The day's lesson? Fractions. Ixcoy is known universally as Lelito 10, a childhood nickname that stuck. He tries to visit each of his students twice a week. The classroom on a trike was born of necessity. Ixcoy quickly realized there were challenges to remote learning in this farming community in Guatemala's western highlands. I tried to get the kids their worksheets sending instructions via WhatsApp, but they didn't respond, Ixcoy said. Parents told me that they didn't have money to buy data packages for their phones and others couldn't help their children understand the instructions. Illiteracy in the area is about 42%, and in the entire department or province, only about 13% of homes have internet. The cell phones they have at home are very basic, Ixcoy said. They can't download apps like Zoom that would allow you to have a virtual class. The families he serves often struggle to stave off hunger. One day the mother of a student told him they didn't have food, Ixcoy said. When the class ended and I began to ride away on my tricycle, she calls me and with a look of gratefulness says, "Teacher, they gave me some food. I want to share half with you." I arrived home crying, he recalled. Moving over to the Metro and Iowa section, Iowa school districts waiting on state still want guidance for online learning exemptions. A week and a half after Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds declared that the state schools must conduct at least half of core instruction in person, and with just a month until classes begin, the state has yet to explain how school districts can request temporary exemptions. Multiple districts had already drawn up plans to provide mainly online instruction, while others are concerned they may need to quickly transition in the event of a local COVID-19 outbreak. In addition, some administrators and teachers say it's unsafe to reopen schools while cases of COVID-19 in Iowa continue to rise. The state reported 253 new confirmed cases and 7 more deaths on Tuesday, for a total of 836 COVID-19-related deaths in Iowa. In many districts, officials are wringing their hands while they wait for the Iowa Department of Education to detail basic information on the exemption process, such as criteria for determining which districts get temporary approval. Several districts have contacted the Department of Education to discuss their reopening plans, but just 3 have submitted written requests to start the school year online, said department spokesperson Heather Doe. Rolling Green Elementary in Urbandale, which runs on a year-round schedule, is the sole school in Iowa so far to get approval to conduct most classes online. That permission extends only through August 6th. The state has told the Ames and Iowa City Community School Districts to hold their request until next week, when more guidance is expected to be announced, Doe said. Reynolds' July 19 proclamation is forcing some districts to consider whether they have to scrap their earlier efforts and start over, weeks after the state asked districts to submit 3 distinct plans for reopening, in-person, online, and a hybrid of the two. Among them is the Urbandale Community School District, where the Board of Education will meet Wednesday to discuss an updated version of its original hybrid plan approved in June. The new proposal, like the ones being considered in many districts across the state, calls for 2 groups of students who will alternate attendance days. Group A would attend classes in person on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday of 1 week, then Tuesday and Thursday of the next. Group B would have the opposite schedule, giving each group a total of 5 in-person instruction days every 2 weeks. other districts are vowing, in a show of resistance to the governor, to stick by their existing plans. They include Des Moines Public Schools, where K-8 students will attend classes in person twice a week, and high school students will go to school once a week, utilizing remote learning on other weekdays. Students also can opt to take all of their classes online. Last week, Des Moines Superintendent Tom Ahart said he would most likely apply for the same state approval already granted to Rolling Green, but first needed more guidance on the process. It's unclear what will happen if a school district such as Des Moines doesn't get that clearance and goes ahead with its plans anyway. Lynn Hicks, spokesperson for the Iowa Attorney General Tom Miller, declined to discuss potential consequences, saying he can't comment on any legal advice we have provided, and we have not issued any legal opinions on this issue. Des Moines public school officials have publicly discussed suing the state if it seeks to prevent the district from implementing its plans. While Iowa's largest school district awaits more information from the state, thousands of students there continue to register for online classes ahead of the Friday deadline. As of Monday morning, more than 18,000 DMPS students had registered for fall classes, with 31% choosing the all-online option. That includes more than 1,500 high school students, according to district spokesman Phil Roeder. The fact of the matter is, for all practical purposes, the school year is already underway at DMPS and many districts, as registration is in the works, Roeder said. We've got a lot of work to do, and, with the start of the school year now less than a month away, we need to keep doing it. The Urban Education Network of Iowa, a nonprofit coalition of the state's 18 largest school districts, is appealing directly to the governor to ask for more local decision-making power. In a July 24th letter to Reynolds, it decried her statewide requirements for primarily in-person learning as burdensome, overly restrictive, and potentially pushing schools beyond our capacity to socially distance. Retirement homes, packing plants, prisons all have a common element with schools. Lots of people, especially in our urban schools, in small spaces, the letter said. As leaders of the state's largest school systems, we are convinced that local school boards are in the best position to examine local health data trends and determine if returning to a normal in-person instructional model is appropriate or if it's too soon and would place our students, their families, our staffs, and communities at further risk. Council Bluffs Community School District Superintendent Vicki Murillo, who chairs the Urban Education Network of Iowa, said the wait for more information is adding pressure to an already tense situation. It's adding more stress, waiting on the additional guidance, because we want to make sure that we're compliant with what they release, Morello said. Until we have more clarification, all districts are in limbo and may be positioning themselves to request that. The network's letter also says that Reynolds' proclamation contradicts a state law that recognizes school boards' power to determine when districts should modify education plans. The extra step of seeking approval from the state could delay response times to future outbreaks at schools, Merlo said. If we would have to transition between one phase to another, it could really cause some delay, which would again leave districts in limbo if they were dealing with an outbreak or with cases and contact tracing, she said. Murillo said the group has not heard back from the governor, but understands that Reynolds, just like educators across the state, is busier than ever. All of us are in a new normal, she said. We're trying to figure out exactly how to set up safe, healthy school and learning environments for our students. Tony Lays writes, doctors' groups urge mask mandate, but governor hasn't changed her stance. Groups representing thousands of Iowa physicians and other medical professionals urged Governor Kim Reynolds on Monday to require mask wearing to help rein in the coronavirus and the deadly disease it causes. Consistent, widespread use of cloth masks in public settings will dramatically slow the spread of COVID-19 and save lives, the Iowa Medical Society and 14 other health professional groups said Monday in a letter to the governor. The letter represented an unusual consensus among Iowa medical professionals on a controversial topic. It added pressure on Reynolds to join more than half of the other governors in ordering residents to wear masks in public. Until recently, Reynolds regularly appeared near other people in public places without wearing a mask. She endorsed the Iowa Department of Public Health's Mask Up campaign last week, but has said cities and counties lack the authority to invoke their own mask mandates without her permission. Her spokesman, Pat Garrett, said Monday that her stance hasn't changed. Governor Reynolds encourages Iowans who are interacting with others where social distancing is impossible to wear masks, but she does not believe a governmental mask mandate is appropriate, he wrote in an email to the Des Moines Register. The health professional's letter noted that after seeing a June decline in coronavirus cases, hospitalizations, and deaths, Iowa is now seeing a resurgence, including in nursing homes. By Monday, the state had recorded 829 deaths from COVID-19, and hospitalizations due to it have more than doubled in Iowa since June. Requiring masks now could increase safety while Iowans continue to take steps toward normal life, the medical professional's letter says. A statewide mask order is the surest way to ensure that our schools, businesses, and healthcare facilities are able to reopen and stay open, and that our medical practices are able to continue to offer a full array of care for Iowa patients. The Iowa Medical Society represents more than 6,000 physicians and medical students. This spring, it urged Reynolds to join many other governors in invoking shelter-in-place orders to stem the epidemic. The Medical Society's stance on that issue was seconded by the Iowa Board of Medicine, whose members are appointed by the governor to regulate health care. But Reynolds declined to follow their recommendations. The Iowa Board of Medicine did not sign Monday's letter seeking a mask mandate, but the signatories included the presidents of organizations representing family doctors, pediatricians, emergency physicians, medical examiners, nurse practitioners, physician assistants, and pharmacists. Iowa Medical Society President Brian Privett, a Cedar Rapids eye surgeon, said he can't recall another time when so many health care associations signed on to such a strong letter. We all view COVID through the same lens, he said in an interview. Doctors and their colleagues have seen firsthand how devastating COVID-19 can be, he said. He added that he and his colleagues appreciate how Reynolds and other leaders are encouraging mask use. But what we're seeing is just not working, he said. The pandemic's resurgence requires a new round of precautions, he said. Privett acknowledged that a mandate would be tough to enforce, but he said such a requirement from the governor would underscore how important it is to wear a mask to prevent transmission of the virus. At this point, he said, many patients still seem unsure whether masks really help. There's a lot of confusion and misinformation out there, he said. Last week, the Iowa Public Health Association and Dr. Patricia Quinlisk, who was Iowa State epidemiologist for 24 years before retiring in 2018, made similar calls for a mask mandate. And from Davenport, Iowa girl missing for weeks without answers. Baricia Terrell was last seen July 10th in Davenport. It's been nearly 3 weeks since Baricia Terrell, age 10, was last seen in Davenport, and her family still has few answers about her disappearance. Terrell went missing on July 10th after spending the night with her half-brother and his father, Henry Earl Dinkins, a registered sex offender. 5 days later, an Amber Alert was issued, prompting Terrell's family to ask why it took so long. Chief Strategy Officer for the City of Davenport, Sarah Ott, said detectives discovered new information that met the requirements set by the state for an Amber Alert to be issued, but declined to provide details. On July 16th, Davenport police announced searches would be conducted in Clinton County. By July 20th, the search in Clinton County ended. It's unclear what led police to coordinate a search, consisting of volunteers and local agencies, in Clinton County or what was discovered from the search. In a July 20th news release announcing an end to the search in Clinton County, Davenport police stated their efforts are focused on leads in Davenport, but did not specify what those leads are. The Federal Bureau of Investigation office in Omaha, Nebraska, last week announced a $10,000 reward for information leading to Terrell's return. The reward is separate from the $3,500 offered by the Quad Cities Crime Stoppers. Davenport police have yet to respond to the Register's multiple requests for comment. A. Shea Langford, Terrell's mother, says she too is left with few answers, although she understands why police are withholding information to protect her daughter and the investigation. Each day is a new challenge, said Langford, who described feeling angry and anxious. She views photos of her daughter every morning, which she says provides her strength. I had a dream just the other night I found her walking on the highway, Langford told the Register Monday. Those are dreams. I wake up and I cry, and I cry. But for Bree, I'm the strong one. Terrell went to Dinkins' apartment in the 2700 block of East 53rd Street with her half-brother, Dinkins' son, for an overnight stay on July 9th, Langford said. Terrell texted her mother using Dinkins' phone shortly after 9 p.m. to tell her goodnight. Langford hasn't heard from her daughter since and believes her daughter is still alive. Davenport police named Dinkins, age 47, as a person of interest in the girl's disappearance. Authorities said he isn't currently a suspect, but they believe he does have information valuable to Terrell's return. Dinkins was already in police custody for violating sex offender registration requirements. He pleaded guilty to third-degree sexual abuse in 1990, involving a girl who was 13 or younger, and a probation violation after officers searched his home looking for Terrell on July 10th. Terrell, who is 4 feet 5 inches tall, weighs about 75 pounds and has brown eyes and black hair, and was wearing a white t-shirt, shorts, and sandals when she went missing. She was last seen near Dinkins' apartment in the early hours of July 10th. Police are asking the public to come forward with information about Dinkins' whereabouts from 10 p.m. on July 9th through noon on July 10th. In addition, police are seeking information about vehicles associated with Dinkins during that time, including a maroon 2007 Chevrolet Impala and a black 2012 Chevrolet Camaro and a motorhome. Dinkins remains at Scott County Jail for the sex offender registry and probation violations to which he pleaded not guilty. Recently filed court documents show Dinkins is wanted by the state of Illinois after failing to appear in court in April 2019 on meth charges. According to Bureau County, Illinois online court records, Dinkins is charged with delivery or possession with intent to deliver over 900 grams of methamphetamine and manufacturing and delivery, or the intent to deliver, over 200 grams of amphetamines or an analog of the drug. He will not be extradited to Illinois until his pending charges in Iowa are settled, court documents indicate. Dinkins' lawyer, Jack Dustemer, declined the register's request for comment. Langford said Dinkins isn't talking about her daughter's disappearance and refused a visit from her at the Scott County Jail on Thursday. She has previously said Dinkins broke down when he saw Terrell's face on an imprint on a t-shirt during an earlier visit, but denied having information that could help locate her daughter. Langford told the Register in an interview earlier this month that Dinkins and she aren't close and only see each other every couple of months when Dinkins wants to see his son. Langford said although she was aware Dinkins was on the sex offender registry, she and her daughter never felt unsafe around Dinkins, and that Terrell had been around Dinkins since she was an infant. Terrell had never stayed overnight at Dinkins' house before she went missing. Langford told the Register she allowed it this one time because Terrell was having fun with her half-brother and wanted to stay. Now she feels her children are unsafe around anyone. "I'm still waiting for my baby to come home," she told the Register on Monday. Charles Fletcher writes, "Residents file lawsuit to block stadium. Des Moines Public Schools unlawfully deprived residents of their rights when it ignored a petition calling for a public vote on the district's plans to build a $19.5 million stadium in partnership with Drake University, according to a lawsuit filed by four Des Moines residents. The plaintiffs are members of Save Our Stadiums, a grassroots group that circulated a petition in May and June seeking to force a special election. The lawsuit filed Tuesday morning in the Iowa District Court of Polk County claims the school district's failure to hold a vote affects a total and complete disenfranchisement of the electorate and violates the 14th Amendment and Due Process Clause of the Constitution. It asked the court to compel Des Moines Public Schools to either abandon the project or hold a public vote. It also seeks an injunction to stop the district from issuing bonds for the project until after a public vote. We're dealing with a fundamental right to vote, and that's just not something we can walk away from," Des Moines attorney Gary Dickey said. He represents plaintiffs Daniel Pardock, Katie Pilcher, Tamara Rood, and Daniel Twelmeyer in the lawsuit, which names the Des Moines Independent Community School District and seven school board members as defendants. "It doesn't matter what the issue is. Everybody ought to have the right to vote when it's been granted to them," Dickey said. "It just so happens that this is an important issue because these stadiums are the life center of our neighborhoods on fall and winter Friday nights." Des Moines Public Schools said in a statement Tuesday that it's unfortunate that time and money must now be spent on this issue, but we are confident in a successful outcome so that we continue making sure students in Des Moines have access to high-quality facilities like students elsewhere in Iowa. The Board of Education unanimously approved an agreement with Drake University on July 7th to build a 4,000-seat stadium east of the Knapp Center. It would serve as the home football field for four of Des Moines' five high schools and host high school and Drake soccer games. Opponents say the combined stadium, which would be located more than 2 miles from the closest school, would create barriers for students and fans who want to participate in high school athletics and threaten revenue for high school booster clubs and erode community spirit built around home football games. The crux of the lawsuit comes down to whether the 7,120 signatures collected by members of Save Our Stadiums is enough to force a public vote on the stadium. Des Moines Public Schools contend that 7,501 signatures are required, 30% of the total 25,004 ballots cast in the November 5th general election, the first time that school and city elections were held on the same day in the state. The lawsuit contends only 5,335 signatures are needed, 30% of the 17,843 voters who cast a ballot in the school board election. Dickey said Tuesday that the Des Moines School Board resolution and the state statute specifically say a petition must be signed by at least 30% of those voting in the last election of school officials to force a public vote. "It's not even a close question," he said. "We don't think the statute allows them any ability to ignore our demand for a public referendum." Des Moines Public Schools said Tuesday that Iowa law is clear about the requirements for a petition to require an election. "The plaintiff simply did not meet that legal requirement, and the school board proceeded with this important project according to state law." Dickey says the plaintiffs are ready to take the issue to the Iowa Supreme Court, which could tie the project up for years. "Because of COVID, there is such a backlog of criminal and civil cases, you may not get a jury trial until 2022, and you add an appeal on top of that, and it might not get resolved until 2024, he said. "The school board ought to just put it to vote and make the case to the community. If they can't do that, let's start construction immediately. Let's not wait until 2024. But if they can't make their case, they need to start Plan B today instead of waiting until 2024. Des Moines Public Schools and Drake University plan to build the stadium on the north side of Forest Avenue. It would serve as the home field for the Hoover, Lincoln, North, and Roosevelt football teams and soccer teams from all five high schools would play some games there. Drake Stadium would be available for high school football games on Friday nights when multiple Des Moines schools host home games. The East High football team would continue to play its home football games at Williams Stadium on the east side. Des Moines Public Schools contends the combined stadium is a cheaper alternative to renovating stadiums at Hoover, Lincoln, and North High Schools, and building a standalone stadium for Roosevelt, which currently plays its home games at Drake Stadium. The district estimates those projects could cost a combined $60 million, a number that opponents of the combined stadium reject. Des Moines instead plans to use $15 million in sales tax revenue to build one shared stadium. Drake would fund the remaining $4.5 million through donations and be responsible for maintaining the facility. Drake would use the stadium for men's and women's soccer games. It also would be available for activities such as high school marching band festivals and rugby matches, as well as middle school football and soccer games. Des Moines Superintendent Tom Ahart previously said the district plans to use money it would normally spend to rent Drake Stadium for Roosevelt's home football games to pay for pep buses to get students and fans to games at the new stadium. Money from concessions at high school football games would go to the home team's booster club, Ahart said. Ankeny Proclamation asks residents to wear face masks. Order is not a mandate, but still controversial. Ankeny Mayor Gary Lorenz signed a proclamation Monday asking residents to wear masks or face coverings in public areas to limit the spread of COVID-19. Lorenz's proclamation says the city encourages people in Ankeny to practice social distancing and to wear face shields or cloth masks when in close proximity with other people. City Council members Mark Holm and Carrie Walter Ashby and Polk County Supervisor Steve Van Ort joined Lorenz for the signing. "We're all in this together," said Lorenz. "Wearing a mask is a simple step we can all take to protect the safety of our neighbors, family, and our favorite businesses. As cases continue to rise in our community, it is critical that we do everything we can to protect it." Unlike recent orders issued by mayors in Muscatine and Iowa City, the Ankeny Proclamation is not a mandate. people can still choose whether to wear a mask in public places. Governor Kim Reynolds has said city and county governments do not have the authority to mandate wearing masks without her approval. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommends wearing face coverings when in public settings, maintaining 6 feet of social distance from other people, and avoid gatherings of 10 or more people. In Iowa, health officials, including the Iowa Medical Society and representatives of 14 other state health and medical groups, in a Monday letter, have called for the governor to issue a statewide mask mandate. But Reynolds has declined to do so. Reiterating Reynolds' position, her spokesperson, Pat Garrett, wrote an email to the Des Moines Register on Monday that the governor encourages Iowans who are interacting with others where social distancing is impossible to wear masks, but she does not believe a governmental mask mandate is appropriate. Though Lorenz's proclamation did not mandate mask wearing, it was controversial. In the 4 hours after it was posted on the city's Facebook page, over 700 people alternately praised and condemned it. Horrible decision. Extremely disappointed, wrote one resident. Thank you, Mayor Lorenz, Carrie Walters Ashby, and Mark Holm. It is great to see Iowa residents speak up to protect others, wrote another. The city of Ankeny is aware that people have differing opinions on wearing masks, city staff wrote in a social media post. However, by following the recommended guidance of CDC health officials, we're also recognizing the role we can play to help protect the health and well-being of our community. As of 10 a.m. Monday, the state reported 829 COVID-related deaths since the pandemic reached Iowa and 42,485 confirmed cases. Tony Lays writes, Detention Center for Boys sees 17 infected. Outbreak started last week in Eldora. 12 students and 5 staff members at Iowa's detention facility for boys have become infected with the coronavirus, state officials said Monday. The outbreak at the Eldora Boys State Training School started last week when a staff member tested positive, according to the Iowa Department of Human Services. Department spokesman Matt Hyland said some of the students and staff who tested positive for the virus have come down with symptoms of COVID-19, the disease it causes. None have been hospitalized, he said. All students and staff at the facility are being tested, the department reported. People who test positive have been separated, and the boys' guardians have been notified, it reported. All on-campus visits have been suspended. The school is for adolescents who have been found delinquent in juvenile court for committing crimes. It normally holds about 70 youths from around the state. A federal judge declared in March that the Eldora facility must dramatically change its treatment of boys after she found that they had been subjected to restraints that amounted to torture. The judge was ruling in a civil rights lawsuit brought on behalf of a former student there. State authorities have filed a correction plan, and the facility is under new leadership. A total of 85 residents and staff have become infected at Eldora and the 5 other institutions the Department of Human Services runs, the department reported. And finally, a small update on COVID-19. Overall, positive test in Iowa is at 9.3%. Another 7 people with COVID-19 have died, and there have been an additional 253 confirmed cases, the state reported Tuesday. At 10 a.m. Tuesday, the state was reporting 836 COVID-19-related deaths, an increase of 7 deaths since the state's tally at 10 a.m. Monday, according to the state's coronavirus.iowa.gov website. COVID-19 is the respiratory disease caused by the coronavirus. And that does it for the first hour of the Register on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Disabled. Up next, we'll give a shout-out to all our listeners who are celebrating a birthday today. I'm your reader, Dennis May. Thank you for listening.